Here we go. Oh my goodness.
Less than 60.
Oh, okay. We'll see. Okay. No need to go back to your cottage tonight. here we go. Can you talk about the smile of the saw? A simile of the saw. Okay, I've got the smile. The simile saw for the Kakachupama Sutta spelling. That simile of the saw is a very powerful one. That is the one where if these terrorists, someone says bad people, but I don't say terrorists, if they get hold of you and they get out a saw, not a chainsaw, but one of those old saws, a blunt and rusty one, and they cut off your limb, from your body. Now that must really hurt. And if they torture you like that, if you have one thought of ill will towards those people, then the Buddha said, you're not a disciple of mine. It's a pretty tough one, isn't it? But nevertheless, I amended it a little bit with a blunt saw. But the idea was to say you should give loving kindness to these people. And that was a very tough one. But nevertheless, every now and again, you know, you hear tales of people who actually do that. And the tales which I remember, there was one monk, I think he was captured in Tibet somewhere, and the soldiers in the prison, they did torture him. And all the time that he was, you know, being tortured, all those times, he managed to keep his benevolent mind focused to those torturers. Because he said, you know, when he escaped and he came back to the West, he said, if I had one moment of ill will towards those people, I'd have lost my self-respect. That was the height of his practice. The similar the soul is a very tough one. But it shows that even if they do that much, you don't have to think you have to have ill will towards them. No matter what they're doing to you, you can always, you know, show them loving kindness. Of course, that was an extreme. But how people treat us, they may not torture you, but they may give you a difficult time, a very difficult time. You know, they may just cheat you, they may harass you, you know, you may just, you know, when you go back home after this, you may find your partner is... I'm going to take that further. How do you react? Sometimes these things, just getting ill will, just makes the situation worse. It just adds salt onto the wound. So instead, it doesn't matter, you can still give loving kindness to them. My simile of this, which I developed years ago, was, you know, for the lay people who come on these retreats, just think, I mean, do you really love your partner? Really love them? Isn't their happiness the most important thing? So if you go back and you find that your husband or your partner, your wife, whatever it is, they leave you a note saying, I'm having a wonderful time in this Cable Beach resort with this girl I met on the internet. How would you feel? If you really loved your partner, you'd be so happy that they're having such a good time. Wouldn't you? Second, don't tell your partner that you gave them permission. But instead what it is that, you know, that sometimes people misunderstand love for a little bit of, like, control, owning. It's my relationship, it's my partner. Natural, but sometimes it's wonderful when the standard which the Buddha put up there was so high. If somebody's really torturing you, you give them loving kindness back. And if you can do that, it's amazing just how that, you know, the person who's trying to hurt you, they can't hurt you. Because you give them kindness. Physically they can, but your emotional response is with loving kindness, compassion. And that's wonderful when you see those things happen. One of the stories which I've told, and told the monks as well, that when I was a young monk in northeast Thailand, I was washing my bowl after lunch, as we'd always do, and then afterwards you dry it. And this monk came up to me. You know, he wasn't washing his own bowl, he was a bit senior, he was arrogant. And he came up to me and said, "Yamu Wangso, that's a filthy habit." That's what he said. And I looked and said, "What am I doing wrong?" You're drying your bowl with the same cloth you dried your spittoon. It's a filthy habit. And I looked at all the other monks, they were doing the same. But then I had this moment of inspiration. I said, "Sorry." And I went over to the rag box, got out another cloth, and started drying my spittoon with the cloth from the rag box. And the interesting part of this, because I was not reacting with anger, I must admit I was suppressing it, but I never reacted out of anger. And I felt all the other monks, they'd stopped drying their bowls. They were all looking at me. All these eyes were following me to see what I would do next. And so I came back with the rag from the rag box and went back to where I was sitting before and then drying my spittoon with the rag instead with the other cloth. All the monks were watching me. And as soon as I finished, they looked up to see the response from this arrogant monk. And so did I. And that arrogant monk, his face went red. He was so embarrassed, and he turned around, and he found it so hard to get angry with me ever again. It wasn't worth it, because I never received his anger, and I just followed what he said and showed him up for what a stupid thing that was to do. And so he was embarrassed. It's a wonderful way. So if you've got a boss at work who tells you to do something you shouldn't do, you just do it. And if it's other people watching, they see. And they look at you and they look at the boss, and the boss gets embarrassed. Does that make sense to you? Okay. So there's other ways of dealing with people trying to hurt you, oppress you, force you to do things, than just getting angry back. Just give them kindness. Would you be able to elaborate on this verse of the Metta Sutta? Not busy with duties and frugal in their ways. Sometimes we don't have much choice of the duties of family or job. Oh, I agree with that. I am so busy with my duties of being a monk. Other people say they come and help, but do they help? No, they just give me more duties. And I've got the duties of finding duties to change duties. So this is one of the things you can, even I say this, even I do a lot, you can find some space so you don't have to do those duties. Are they really important? Sometimes you're given duties by others. And sometimes you may not be given duties by others, but you know they're really important. So you do them anyway. And you have fun doing them. But we try our best, you know, even at Bodhinyana Monastery, to try and make it a monastery easy to run. What duties are there? A lot of times, the duties which really take off your energy is arranging stuff. and just, you know, making sure that when people come, there's somebody to greet them or there's talks to be given. You know, now it seems that we've got a lot of good monks at Bodhinyana Monastery, but now, you know, there's so many invitations. People want to teach or want, you know, invite you to teach all over the world. So sometimes you can't always go there yourself. That's one of the reasons why that sometimes you say, oh, there's an invitation to do some chanting to get rid of ghosts. And they want me to go. You know why they want me to go and do it? Because the chanting which I do is so bad that no ghost can stand it. And they run away. But yes, other monks can do that. But nevertheless, you know, you try and do the best you can, but you have to be careful not to overextend yourself. It's one of the things which I remember, it's almost like branded in my memory, is to see Ajahn Chah. You know, that he had a stroke. And with Ajahn Chah, that I just, you know, he had an operation, and then I saw him after the operation. And then I came to Australia. It was another day now, 25th of May, 1983. And a couple of weeks later, Ajahn Chah had a stroke and never spoke again. But I remember just seeing him and just understanding why he had that stroke. And it was because, you know, he was never given a moment's rest. You know, early in the morning, the monks would come and ask him questions about this and that. And then he would walk on the arms round and come back again. People were asking him questions on the arms round. He'd come back, have his meal, and then he'd go sit under his hut, and people would come and talk to him, all of their problems and difficulties and stuff. And even in the evening, Ajahn Chah would often not be able to come to the evening meeting because he was talking with somebody. And even in the evening, some of the monks would have a quiet time with Ajahn Chah because, you know, all the other lay people had gone home. And it was like such a long day for him. When I saw that, I realized that, you know, even monks, you have to look after them, especially the senior monks, especially the old fat senior monks. And trust that when they say they need to rest, that they do need to rest. It's one of the reasons why I've now got into the habit of, in the New Year day. The New Year is such a busy time for me. As you know, I usually go overseas, first of all, Christmas and New Year. Whenever there's public holidays, there's extra work for monks. You have the time off. So that means I have to do more work. So I usually make sure that the last few years. First of January, that's always really busy. But then when I get back here after those New Year's Day's shenanigans, then I can just go to my cave, which you visited today, and then go on a retreat for about a week. It's not a retreat because I need to get into some deep meditation, I just need a rest. And it's a wonderful thing to know that you can work yourself to the bone, and then afterwards that you have a nice place you can be quiet and looked after for 4 or 5 days. And I usually don't see the monks then, except the one who brings the food to me. And then afterwards, after just a week usually, you know, I just feel fully recovered. So that's why, you know, busy with duties, you have to know how much you can do and not do too much. And that's with you as well. And it's again not just knowing not to do too much, but how to do the work. So when you're doing the work, you're not really considering or worried what other people think of you. You do your very best, and that's good enough. If you're worried what other people think of you, then you tense up, and then you get even more tired. You know, it's really easy to be mindful about hard work. You know, it's not how much you produce, You know that story I gave, how heavy is the cup? If you keep on holding it all day, it feels really heavy. But every now and again, you can put it down and rest. You pick it up again, then you put it down and rest. You give yourself multiple rests during the day. Then actually you can, it never feels heavy. You do so much work without getting burnt out. It's how to deal with stress in life. Don't keep on holding it. And know how to let it go. And how to let it go means, you know, once you have that opportunity to have a rest, you don't go thinking, how did I perform? What did I say? Did I do it right? Did I do it wrong? You leave that alone and just rest. You know how to rest efficiently. And that's how to balance, you know, being able to do a lot without letting it overburden you. That makes sense? So not busy with duties, that's really what it means. You have duties, but you don't make yourself feel busy. In one of those little cartoon books, I remember just there was a picture of a guy holding a mobile phone, holding another mobile phone, holding a cup of coffee, you know, with so many hands. They said that's a good definition of being busy, doing too many things at the same time. At least don't do more than one thing at a time. Then you don't look busy, but you get a lot done. Okay. Then next question. What should I do to meet you again or your teachings in the next life? What you have to do, you have to die first. You can't meet me in the next life if you're still alive, this life. Dear Ajahn, is the ego Mara? No, you can't call the ego Mara. Ego, she go, we all have to go. You're laughing at that, goodness gracious. Now, Mara can be symbolic of that part of the ego which is your will. You have a problem, you want to will it away. Someone is causing you difficulties, kick butt. You want to control somebody else, that is Mara. The control freak in chief of the universe, Mara. Sitting in the presence of unconditioned love waves is healing my heart with great gratitude. Sunyo Anamo. I gave interviews to those, I think, was it today or yesterday? Sunyo Anamo. If you looked in the list of people who wrote down their names for interviews, two of those were Sunyo, which was nothing, and Anamo, no name. And if you saw some of the other people who was on the interview list today, this morning, who was there on the interview list? Nalagiri, yeah. Did you see any elephants come into the interview? I just wrote that name down because, you know, you're getting a bit tired, so you want a bit of space. So not Nalagiri. So I can finish 10 minutes early. I shouldn't tell you those tricks. Now you're going to see that and you're going to... you know what it means, so you're going to come anyway. Dear Ajahn, I am more of a Dharma Nai Sari with a bit of faith. Oh, Dhammanusari with a bit of faith. A Dhammanusari, the two types of people on the path of being a stream winner, one's a Dhammanusari, has got some like experience And that is giving them the basis of faith in the Buddha, or the confidence in the Buddha. And the other one just sees like a Buddha or a teacher, and they've got lots of faith in them. But everyone, those two types of people on the path to being a stream winner, it's not as if you don't have any faith at all and just experiential wisdom. It doesn't mean you just have experiential wisdom and no faith. It's always a combination of both. But of those two, it's the experiential wisdom is always much more trustworthy. Because people have faith in all sorts of people. All sorts of scallywags sometimes. That's one of the reasons why just the faith is always a little bit dangerous and dodgy. Just believe me. Have trust in me. Believe in Venerable Nibbuto, and then you'll be happy ever after. It'd be great if there was some sort of guarantee in that. There ain't. Ajahn Bambali mentioned that you have developed it so well that tears come to your eyes when you bow down to the Buddha, the faith thing. And sometimes, you know, I remember once I mentioned, you know, after working really hard here, I had the opportunity to go and visit my family in UK. And I said honestly that when I got to the airport, I was actually crying through the terminal. I hit my toe and it really hurt. No, it's true. How to develop the faith to that level? One of the things is to allow yourself, you know, to feel. Because a lot of people suppress their emotions. And sometimes you think, are we allowed to have emotions as a Buddhist? Good, yes. The good emotions, the positive ones, not the negative ones. You don't have the emotion like of anger or revenge. Remember what I said about revenge? If someone has really been cruel to you and hurt you, there's no need to seek revenge because karma gets the bastards anyway. That's if you're a Buddhist. Karma will sort it out. If you're a Christian, God will sort it out, or Muslim Allah will sort it out. If you're a Hindu, Lord Krishna will sort it out. If you're an atheist, the judge will sort it out in a court of law. You don't have to be the instigator of revenge. In fact, the punishment never works. So that's one of the reasons why I leave it to karma. You don't need to get angry. There was this prisoner who I was teaching over in Karna Prison Farm. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, can I have 5 minutes personal interview with you? It's really important. And of course I said yes. And he said the crime for which he'd been put in jail for, he didn't do. He said, I know every prisoner might say that, but you know, I respect you, Ajahn Brahm. This is honest, truthful. I never did that robbery for which I was put in jail for. When he said that, I felt, you know, this is really unfair, this is not justice. But I also knew by that time, people in jail have very little means to find some recourse. They don't have funds, they don't have lawyers, they can't go and write to many people, they're so limited in those prisons. So I thought, you know, who can I go and call when I get back to the monastery to help this fella? When I was thinking that, he interrupted my thoughts with his cheekiest of smiles. But, Ajahn Brahm, it's true I never did that crime for which I'm serving this sentence. But I did so many other robberies where I wasn't caught. I guess this is fair. He taught me the law of karma. If you're driving down the road and the speed camera catches you, do you get upset? Why me? It's unfair. I was only going 2 kilometres above the speed limit, 2 kilometres an hour, whatever, above the speed limit. But then, how many times were you speeding and you weren't caught? That's fair. Anyway, he taught me the law of karma. Dear Ajahn Brown, thank you to you and everyone for this wonderful retreat. If there is no self, then what goes on to the next life? It's a stream of consciousness. And they say it's not the same, not different. What? How can you explain that? I would say, what do you mean when you spoke of the stream of consciousness having left the body this morning? It's how the Buddha taught. If you stand on a bridge and you watch the water underneath, it will look the same today as it did yesterday. But the water you see today is not the same as the water which you saw yesterday. It's a stream, it's flowed, but it looks the same. Just like your conscious process, it may appear similar, but it's not the same. And so because of that, there's a simile which I tried to develop to explain it more fully. You eat a mango. Did you have any mangoes today?
No.
A mango. We have some nice mangoes over in Bodhinyana Monastery. We did. So anyway, you eat a mango. And having eaten the mango, you've got the seed left. You put the seed in the garden, in a nice place, you know, underneath the ground. It's a good piece of ground. And then you find just a few days later, the seed splits and a little green shoot comes up. A few more days and the green shoot pokes itself up above the top of the soil level, and it looks like a piece of grass at first. But then the days go past and that piece of grass looks like a grass. It's a mango. It gets a little bit thicker at the bottom. It gets like a piece of, like a small stick. And it has a few leaves on the top of that little stick. And it keeps on growing day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. And it becomes a sapling. And soon that sapling becomes a small tree. And that small tree starts to have many branches. And then once it happens, at the end of those branches, there's little flowers can be seen. And those flowers get pollinated and the base of the flowers starts to thicken up. You start, a little mango is growing there. And after a few weeks, then the mango, if you sit very still underneath it and you hold your hand out, very soon the mango will fall, or you can take the mango. And when you take that new mango, is it the same or different than the first mango? It's different, but there's a connection there. It's still a mango, it's not an apple. So the original mango was sweet, this new mango is liable to be sweet. The first mango was drought resistant, and the second mango is liable to have those qualities too. How did that go across from the first mango seed to the new mango? You can't say it's just the DNA, because that alters slightly too. It's not the same, not different. They're connected. And that is like, you can actually see the connections from moment to moment. You can see that first mango, the seed, you can see the seed split, a little piece of green coming up. You can see that grow day by day. It just changes slightly. And over the period, until you get the new tree, that change has grown, and now you see a new tree with a new mango. That's like from this life to another life. You're not different, not the same as what happened before. It's a process. The stream of consciousness is like a process. And that is actually just describing from this life to another life. Does that make sense? I know there's many people who don't believe in rebirth, but don't worry about that because they will in their next life. Dear Ajahn, thank you very much for all the teaching and guidance. I've been taking things for granted until realizing how deep present moment is. It really helps to see the beauty in life. Oh, okay, this is good. And pay gratitude to people around us. Also, thank you for all the volunteers who are doing their best to keep all easy for meditators and for the great Sangha. By the way, how do you stay happy every day? I don't stay happy every day. When I go to my room and close the door, those meditators, all those stupid questions they ask me. No, I don't do that. So how do you stay happy every day? Why not? That's a very good answer. Why not be happy? You've got a choice. You cannot control the world. You can't control what other people say about you. You cannot control your health. Other people try and control your health, and they make you sick, hearing all these things they want to make you do. So instead of that, you just laugh more. This is the world. And the world, after a while, you understand people's nature. And people are always trying to do the very best. Sometimes they do stupid things, thinking that's the very best. It just makes you laugh more. And for a good understanding of that, there was this thing called road rage. I remember one of those examples of road rage which I read about, these two cars, one was following the other, trying to catch up to him in New York. And eventually the fellow was really upset, caught up, you know, with the person he was really upset with at an intersection in New York. The traffic light had gone to red. And this guy was so incensed, he jumped out of the car and started banging on the window of the person he was upset about. The person inside must have been terrified. But the traffic lights changed in time before he broke the window, and his potential victim just drove off. And then this guy, still angry, turned around to get into his car to keep chasing him. But this was New York. A street kid had already got into his car when he jumped out because he was enraged with this other driver. He forgot to turn the engine off, to take the keys out and lock the door. Everything was open. That's what happens when you're enraged. You lose your mindfulness. You don't leave a car with the engine running, no one in it, doors open, anywhere in New York. So we're standing at the intersection, and the car he was chasing disappeared, and so did his own car disappear. There's a kind of justice, I think, to that. So how do you stay happy every day? Just remember those stories. Is success in meditation determined more by sila, dana, sense restraint, having a happy mind, or meditation technique? What percentage importance do you give to each of these factors? Sila, 100%, dana, 100%, sense restraint, 100%, having a happy mind, 100%, being able to count, 0%. You can't have 100% for everything. There are three types of people in this world: those who can count and those who can't. And that's logical. So they're all important. So the sila, this is the virtue. Why? It's number one. you are actually not making your life too complicated if you keep precepts. Just being kind to yourself and kind to others. Kindness is so important for meditation. Sense restraint, you're not stirring yourself up. When somebody comes along and they upset you, why? If they say interesting things, wonderful. If they say things you disagree with, wonderful. You just leave it alone. That means, so dana is really important, because dana is a form of letting go. Remember, I've already mentioned where the letting go boxes are. There was this, I think it's close enough. How many more days have we got for the retreat, Robin?
Lots and lots. We're not leaving.
Not leaving at all. Okay. No, because, sometimes, you need to, get some dana coming in and get some fundraising techniques. And this is one of my favourite fundraising stories. That once there was this young monk, he just started a temple and found it very difficult to raise any funds. It's a hard economic times, people just, you can't expect your disciples to give you lots of money every day. So he went to see a senior monk, and a senior monk gave him advice. He said, next time you give a talk in your temple, turn up the heat, close all the windows to make it stuffy, and give a really boring sermon. And he said, I can do that one, last one, easy. And once everybody in the audience are starting to get sleepy, you actually don't have to do a boring sermon, just answer the question slowly till very late in the night. And once you see people starting to go to sleep, get out your watch and start swinging it. And when you see most of the audience are falling asleep, then you say, before you go to bed tonight, put some donations in the donation box. No coins. No fives, tens or twenties. Fifties or hundreds. That's all. He said, I can't do that. I said, of course you can. That's encouraging people to make good karma. That's our job, to make, allow people to make good karma. So he did that, and he made a fortune that day. The donation box was full of 50s and 100s. No 5s, no 10s, no coins. And so, when he needed money again, he tried it once more. Gave a really boring sermon. When people were about to fall asleep, he got out his watch. He was swinging it back and forth, and that's when he dropped the watch. And he said, shit. And it took them a couple of weeks to clean up the mess. I think that was some karma was working there. As I've been in retreat mode for several days now, my body is quite still. But when I sit, all kinds of thought goes on and on. It feels like my body and mind are going their way separately. How can I stop these thoughts? Don't try to stop the thoughts. You're feeding them if you don't like them. Just notice them, like at a distance. They're not yours. It's just like a TV or the screen of a computer. All this rubbish goes on there. Totally out of control. Just don't look at it. It's not me, not mine, not a self. Distance yourself from it. This is rubbish. Why would you want to look at rubbish? That's also one of the reasons why, if you are thinking such thoughts, be careful. Some monks can read minds. And I've got a microphone. What happens if I tell what you're thinking? That happened to one of these monks, who's quite a famous monk now. They used to always do a 2-hour meditation first thing in the morning before they went on alms round. So this monk was always difficult. 2 hours of meditation, you get sloth and torpor, you get restless. But one day, he was meditating there and he thought, I'll try a sexual fantasy. He wasn't sleepy at all. And the time flew past. But then once the bell rang for the end of the meditation, he was so guilty. What if my teacher has read my mind? And then you can imagine how he felt. But after the bell was rung, everyone bowed, but the teacher came up, walked right up to him, and looked him in the eye. But this shows actually the wisdom and compassion of these teachers. He said, you've just been wasting 2 hours of your time. It wasn't actually criticizing or humiliating him, just telling him, you wasted your time. You haven't got all the time forever. So, next time, it's much better, and even to try and restrain your mind. If it doesn't work today, tomorrow it will get better. You start to learn the tricks of restraint. So I remember him telling me that story, and I thought, just what a wise teacher that was. Should I be telling people what you're thinking about? No, that's not right. That's cool. So anyway, mind going their way separately. How can I stop these thoughts? And also, that when you find some peace in your mind, peace is so beautiful. Are you enjoying the silence of this retreat centre? Yes. Should we change it and just put some loudspeakers everywhere and have constant Ajahn Brahm talks 24/7? Or Venerable Nibbuto talks? No? Ajahn Brahmadi talks? No? Ajahn Chah talks? No, sometimes the beauty of silence is better than even just the beauty of the Buddha's talks. That's what the Buddha is kind of describing. So after a while, you understand what real beauty is. I must admit that when I was young, I remember before I was going to Thailand to become a monk, I had to go to London to get all the visas and stuff. And I used to always go when I was in London, if I wanted a bit of peace and quiet, I'd go into Westminster Abbey. It's huge in there. And I'd just find a quiet place there and sit down and meditate. No one would stop me. But then I went in there just the very last time, just before going to Thailand. I just wanted an hour of quiet and silence to rest after being busy going to embassies and stuff. So when I actually got into there, I was just so disappointed. Because between my last visit and the visit before, they had installed a PA system. And this is what they were broadcasting, like talks from the last Archbishop of Canterbury or something, or other advertisements. Or if you want to get some books, the shop is going to close in 10 minutes. And it was just so noisy in there. And I thought that was desecration. Because silence and calm is sacred. It's something which you can experience. And it just calms you down and makes you peaceful. You can resonate with silence and you become silent too. It's one of the reasons why that when we have a quiet place, please respect it. Okay, what is it? Oh, with those thoughts, yeah. Oh, it's a similar question. Actually, I sit down, make myself comfortable and wait. When the breath comes up, I watch it. At times I can peacefully watch it, but eventually be washed away again with thoughts. Do I keep doing this again and again and wait quietly, patiently, till the breath stays more? P.S. When I intentionally watch the breath, I notice that I can stay with it longer. Which way to go? Find a middle way there. When you're getting peaceful, invite the breath in. In other words, you're not going out there grabbing it and dragging it inside, but invite it in. And see if you can learn how to be a friend with your breathing. I've said this many times on this retreat. If you can look upon your breath like a Kalyana Mitra, and just have this wonderful relationship with your breath, then the breath stays. Have you, just gone walking with one of your best friends? And, you like being with them, so you're looking after them, they're looking after you, and you stay together for a long time. But if you separate with your best friends, that's where you're in trouble. There was a story of this Australian man, I think he was from Sydney, and he went on one of these treks in the Himalayas, in Ladakh. Not actually in Tibet, but in Ladakh. But he was a photographer. So he was photographing all these really interesting flowers and plants. And he was lingering. And so the party of trekkers, they went on ahead. He thought he knew the way, but then he found he'd lost the path. He was really getting lost. And that's very dangerous up in those mountains. There are things like bears. You may have known this in a true story of this nun. And she was attacked by a bear. And the bear actually just, huge black or brown bear, not quite sure what, but put his head right over her head. She's got the scar marks on her head because she shaves her hair off. You can actually see the ring of scar marks where the bear put its mouth right over her head. And interestingly, when I asked, that must have really hurt, she said, no, it didn't. Because what was dominant at the time was the terrible bad breath of the bear. And that was so stinky. And anyway, she did some chanting and the bear sort of was afraid and ran off. And another interesting part of that story, that her boyfriend managed to take her down to the nearest village. And there, she was treated. So she didn't die, they stopped the flow of blood and the wounds healed up. Except, from that day on she had a headache. And the headache just would not sort of go away. And it was after a couple of years that they took this really seriously. And so they gave her a CT scan of her head, her brain. And they found out the cause for the headache. There was a little tree growing in her brain. A small thing. But when the bear had actually put his jaw and dirty teeth over her head, it actually just injected a tiny seed from one of the plants. And it was actually growing in her brain. Weird, but anyway, they gave an operation, took the seed out, and that was the end of the headache. What was I saying? Oh yes. And so this guy got lost. I got lost too. And it's getting late at night. And if it's really dark, he'd really be in trouble. It's also very cold up there. And so he saw in the distance some lights, some sort of habitation, so he went, walked towards those lights. When he actually got there, he found it was an old monastery. And there's lots of Buddhist monasteries in that part of the world. So he knocked on the door, they let him in, and they said, yeah, quite a few people get lost on these treks. And so he said, you know, we know where the trekking group goes, and it's a common, that they go to the next village or town. We can't take you there now, it's too dark. So you can stay in this monastery tonight, and we'll take you there tomorrow. And the abbot said, you know, you're a Westerner, you know, we usually sleep on the floor. There's one bed in the monastery, it's my bed in my room, the abbot's room, but you can sleep there tonight. I'll sleep somewhere else. Monks are always nice like that. We even let you spend the afternoon looking at my bedroom. I actually live there. It's not just a tourist trap. I think I'm the only person in Australia whose bedroom is a tourist trap. But anyhow, so he slept there that night, except what happened in the middle of the night, around midnight, he was woken up by this incredibly beautiful sound. It was not just a noise, it was like music. Only just the most sonorous, gorgeous, beautiful music he'd ever heard in his life. And it was just so thrilling. His eyes were weeping with joy. It really got into him. You know, sometimes there's some music which is so incredible, but it was more incredible than that. And so he was listening to it for a few minutes, and it was so gorgeous that he fell fast asleep. Anyway, in the morning when he woke up, they had some breakfast ready for him, and they were going to get one of the monks to take him to where the rest of the trek party was staying that night so he could join up with them again. He said thank you to the abbot, but he said, last night, in the middle of the night, I heard this incredible, beautiful music. What was it? And the abbot said, you heard that too. He said, yeah, it was gorgeous. Now you go to the Sydney Opera House, I've heard nothing as beautiful like that performed in the Opera House. What was it? And the monk said, sir, I'm not allowed to tell you what that sound, what that music was. Oh, come on. No, sir, I can't. It's monastic rules. So the Australian got out his wallet. Is $100 enough? No, you can't bribe me. 500? I have to know. Sir, even if you gave me $1,000, I couldn't tell you. So he got out $1,000. No, I can't. I can only tell other monks what that sound was. And the Westerner was arguing, please let me know. But the head monk said, no, I can't tell you. And it's time for you to go, otherwise you'll miss your party, the rest of the trekking party. So he had to leave. Anyway, when he eventually got back to Sydney, he got obsessed with the most beautiful sound in the world. He couldn't get it out of his head. He even actually couldn't sleep at night thinking of that. So over in Sydney, he went to see a psychologist and a psychiatrist. They tried everything to try and wean him off this obsession. And in the end, there's only one way of overcoming that obsession. He travelled back to Ladakh, found that monastery, and entered the monastery and said to the abbot, do you remember me? I was here a year ago. Yeah, I remember you. I need to know what that sound is. Sir, I told you, it doesn't matter how much money you brought this time, I cannot tell you. I can only tell monks. Exactly, said the Australian. Ordained me as a monk. So he said, it takes a couple of years of training to be a monk. Is that right, Anagarikas who are here? So, he said, train me. So they gave him the Anagarika precepts, and 1 year later became a novice monk, and after 2 years he finally had his full ordination. And after the full ordination, you know what he said? Now, tell me, what was that sound? He'd been waiting for 3 years. And the abbot said, look, I can do better than tell you. This evening, come to my room, and I will show you. And this Australian was just so excited. So he was there just before midnight. And at midnight, the abbot was there, he was there. And just at midnight, the sound started again. It's incredibly beautiful music. And you can imagine just how excited he was. He was trembling. His tears were coming into his eyes. Then the abbot revealed, just behind a curtain in the abbot's office, there was a door. A very old wooden door. And the abbot got out these wooden keys. He put this wooden key into the door, turned it, and it hadn't been opened for years. So it actually creaked as he opened the door. And then when he opened the door, obviously the music was even easier to hear. And the guy was really excited. And so he said, we've just got to walk down this passage. And at the end of that passage, there was an iron door. And so the head monk got out the iron keys, put it into the lock. And that was really a bit rusty. And he opened that iron door. And the music, the sound, whatever you call it, was even more clear. And I opened that rusty old door. And they both walked through. And the end of the next passage, there was a really big silver door. And it had lots of jewelry in it. So the abbot took out the silver key, put it in the door, in the key, turned it, and opened the door. And now that music was just so clear and much easier to listen to, louder. And this poor fellow was just, tears were streaming down his face. It was the most beautiful thing he's ever heard anywhere in his whole life. And they walked to the end of this corridor. And the very end, the last door, was a golden door. Solid gold, with the most precious of jewels inlaid into that door. And the noise was really clear now. And the fellow was like trembling with fear and anticipation. And the head monk stopped and turned around to him and said, sir, what's on the other side of this golden door is something supernatural. The source of the most beautiful sound in the world. Are you sure you can actually cope with this? Some people go crazy, they go mad when they see this. Are you sure? The abbot was being serious. But this man said, look, for 3 years I've been waiting for this. If I don't find out, I'll be crazy anyway. I almost was crazy in Sydney. I have to know. Okay, said the head monk. And the head monk put the golden key in the door, turned it, and opened the door. You know what was inside? I'm sorry, I can't tell you, you're not a monk. I think you've heard that before. It's a good tale. Can I use imagery during meditation? Why not? E.g., when you spoke about shining kindness over an issue of blockage, I picture a torch of kindness. When focusing a blockage, when facing a blockage, and I should be on a walking path and backtracking to find an alternative path around. Yes, you can use imagery, but don't make it too serious. Remember some of the imagery which you get with nimittas. you can get some complicated limiters sometimes. And that's actually that, one of the early limiters I got was actually seeing this beautiful landscape, you know, green hills with a river down in the valley and lots of beautiful trees. It was beautiful, but it was complex. But then I noticed one of the trees, on one of the branches, on one of the leaves, there was something sparkling on the tip of one of the leaves, a dewdrop. And I knew intuitively that that's where I allowed myself to zoom in. I zoomed in on this sparkling dewdrop, and that became this gorgeous big nimitta. Look for the most beautiful part of what you're seeing. Focus in on that. But on another occasion, this is real, on the story about the most beautiful sound in the world, that was a bit sort of concocted. But this story is true, that when I was meditating, I saw a nimitta, I was getting very peaceful, but the nimitta I saw was of a monster. His big face came right in front of me. And the eyes were like almost popping out of the eye sockets, all red. And there's the eyebrows, you know, coming down in the middle, like it was very angry. And this was a long time ago. The hair was spiky. You know, this was way before punks. And that's what it looked like. And then its teeth were all sort of like sharp, that's what they call those things which suck blood? The vampires. Yeah, all like vampire teeth with blood on it. And around its neck was like a necklace of tiny heads. And as I saw it, it went, its tongue came out. I wasn't afraid, honestly, because I knew this was a creation of my mind. If my mind created it, I can actually continue messing around with it. So, his big, scary eyes, I put sunglasses on them. Like a pair of Ray-Bans at the time. And then on its mouth, I blacked out a few teeth like you did at school, you know, with doodling. So it looked like this monster needed to see a dentist pretty quickly. And on its corner of its mouth, I put a cigarette. And on its head, with sharp hair, the punk hair, I put a straw hat with a flower coming out. I humiliated that monster. When I had finished with my doodles, I laughed. And that monster never came back to see me ever again. That's how you can deal with scary things. Have fun with them. And anyway, so that's how you can use some visualizations to help with your nimittas, or any type of meditation. Dear Ajahn, you are so cute. That's what it says. Your cave is also so cute. The bat, there's a bat in the cave, is also very cute. Thank you for being cute. Much love and respect to you. I don't know what to make of that, but anyway, I'll give this to Robin. Can you check this handwriting with all the applications? No.
Is there a phone number?
No, I don't have a phone number, anything. And get some fingerprints. Oops, another way around. Dear Ajahn Brahm, have you heard of Tom Bilyeu, the teacher people to thinkicati? He calls it thinkitation.
Yeah.
Oh, he teaches people to thinkitate. Instead of like meditate, I suppose. Basically, is it about thinking? I don't know the detail how he teaches. If meditation is about non-thinking, can it all be about thinking? Meta-meditation is thinking a series of specific thoughts to generate the feeling of kindness. Yeah, but the thoughts are not the kindness, it generates it. The match is not the fire. So once you've lit the fire, you can put the matches away. Why do Buddhists teach, may I be well and happy, and not may I be kind? Saying may I be well and happy is being kind, it includes it. But if you can change it, may I be well and be kind as well. Does it work? Why didn't you say, may I be miserable? Why I have a terrible sleep tonight? Because sometimes many of you are rebellious. I've told a few of you that you're rebellious. Since you're not here. So you can tell yourself, I'm going to have a terrible sleep tonight. And then your rebellious nature will do the opposite. Is that worth a try? Okay. What is the direct translation of metta? Thank you. Loving kindness is pretty good. Care, kindness. So remember, some of these words don't have direct translations into English. They are, you know, Pali Sanskrit words. But you get a few words which can describe it to you. Loving kindness, care is pretty good. That's why I keep on going back to samatha being stillness, not concentration. Why even the other one, like vedana, being experience, not feeling. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between dying and jhana? Thank you. So if you get into a jhana, you get reborn pretty quickly in this body, same old place, same old heart, same old meditation hall. If you're dying, we have to get rid of your body. Jhana is where the five senses disappear, but they don't end yet. So when you come out of the jhanas, you get to the same body, same five senses, a continuation of those five senses, but your body has disappeared for a while. It's much closer to a near-death experience. But in a near-death experience, people like float outside the body. Here you don't float outside your body, you're deep inside. And the difference between death and jhanas, as I said before, in the jhanas the body remains warm. In death it goes cold. Which chanting can keep healing, e.g. cancer patients, with metta? Sometimes it's not the chant, the form of the chant, but it's, as I said yesterday, the person who does the chanting, the energy they put into that chanting. And they're focusing the power of their mind to actually to wish. Wish is not a word, but to actually put that energy into that person so they can get better. Or sometimes to die peaceful. I told that story already to you one of the first days. About, didn't I? Yeah, about just going to, I really sacrificed myself, had to get into a car quickly, go to Royal Perth Hospital, get in the ICU, and that was about a couple of hours to even get there, and do this chanting for this poor Chinese guy who was in a coma, was dying. And I did everything I could, and it worked, he got better. He actually came out of the coma, almost like a miracle. And then when I see the family, that's when I got into trouble. They told me, I asked you to come here to chant, not that he will get better, to chant so he will have a peaceful death. Different chant. I did the wrong one. But sometimes also, only once I've done this, that at a marriage, we do specific chanting of marriages, but this marriage, and I was really tired and I've been working too hard, so honestly I did the funeral chant instead of the marriage blessing. It's not on purpose, but they're still happily married. I heard some teachers say the moment is always, this moment is always for our highest good. The universe is always friendly. Every experience, whether it's rape, death of a child, murder, sickness, is exactly what the universe gives us for enlightenment, spiritual growth and happiness. Do you agree? It's hard to agree with that, isn't it? But nevertheless, it's happened. So why it happened, whether it's for the best or not the best, we make it for the best. Is such claim true in your opinion? Not really. Thank you very much for all your teaching. But like a serious event in my life, and also just one I found amazing, that when I was many years ago again in Kuala Lumpur with the Buddhist Gem Fellowship over there, they said there was one of their members was just really in deep trouble. She had some sort of trauma and no one was able to help her. And many of the counsellors, psychologists, psychiatrists tried everything they had, but nothing worked. So I knew I wouldn't ask what the problem was, because I knew I had to be much more in this moment and react in an unconventional way, because the conventional ways have all been tried and don't work. So it's quite shocking. But anyway, she told me about how she'd been very violently raped. It was really nasty to hear. But all the time she was telling me, I was lots of loving kindness, but also stillness. And then when she finished, it was my turn to speak. What I said shocked me. I said to her, "You are so lucky to have been raped like that." You can't say that intentionally. It came out. She was shocked. She was shocked. Once I said that, I could work backwards why I said that. And I said, "Look, I've never been raped in my life. I don't know what you went through, but I can somehow sense you're an incredibly strong woman. You'll find your way out of that difficult black hole you've found yourself in. And then once you've found your way out, you will find what the meaning is. You'll be able to talk to other women who've been through that or worse than that. And you'll be able to put your arm around them and say, 'I know how you feel.' That's something I will never be able to do. You'll be able to say, 'I know how you feel, but most importantly, I know the way out. Take my hand and come with me.'" And I said, "That is, if you like, the meaning of what you've been through. You'll be able to help and serve so many others in the future." And just that little contribution of giving the meaning to those experiences made a lot of difference to her. And again, honestly, I was shocked those words came out of my mouth. I could never do that intentionally. But that's how I trusted, the insight and intuition, and saying something which no one else had said. So that's sometimes where you can trust, your mind. And you can say some things which are just really weird, but can be actually very effective. Next question. Can a novice monk commit a parajika offence? And what happens? And what punishment if he does? Now, the parajika offences for monks, just for monks, are sexual intercourse, stealing. Has to be stealing something of value and acting like a thief to stealing it. Killing another human being. That's also abortion. You know, if the monk does it or the monk tells a person to do it. And lastly, this claiming of supernormal powers, which you don't have. Novice can't do that. You have to be a monk to be expelled. But if, say, we have a novice over there, Dayalu, if you go and kill Venerable Nibbuto, he says, it's not a paratika, fair, but you're still going to go to jail. So there's other penalties there as well as the monastic penalties. But for the novice, the monastic penalties don't apply. So what happens when you're a naughty novice? There's actually nothing much you can do with a naughty novice. What you can do, you can tell him to, you can expel him. Just, you know, don't stay here anymore, go to another place. But you can't hit him. You can't stop him having any food. Yeah. Because sometimes the monks tried that, and the Buddha said, no, they always have to eat. So there's nothing much you can do. I shouldn't have said that, should I? Okay, a few more questions. When an irritating medical condition prevents one breathing through the nose, how should breath meditation be approached? Not being able to breathe through the nose is distressing. I went through that. I had hay fever. Sometimes I couldn't breathe through my nose for weeks. I was so blessed by that. Which, what that meant is I had to find another way of meditating instead of like watching the tip of my nose. And sometimes of the year when there's no hay fever, you could breathe through your nose, no problem. But sometimes of the year, your nose was all blocked up. You know, sometimes I would sit there with a tissue and blow my nose and clear the nose, and then you could breathe through the nose again, but it soon block up again. That's not going to work. But, you know, I wasn't breathing through my nose, but I was still breathing. And I worked that one out, that if I wasn't breathing, I'd be dead. So I could still ask myself the question, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? I don't know where the breath was going, and I didn't care. It was mostly going in through my mouth. But it was going in, that's enough. It was going out, that's enough. And so I just noticed the breath going in, the breath going in. Where it was going in, I didn't know. And that's all you have to do to fulfill the Anapanasati. Anapanasati is the awareness with the breath. It's not Ananosasati. You're not supposed to be watching the nose or your belly. You'd be watching the breath. You may think I'm just being really, really overly precise, but it made a lot of difference to me and to many others. Because I could, what I call these days, disembody the breath. I didn't attach the breath to any part of the body. So I could always watch the breath. Even if you haven't got a blocked nose, so sometimes people watch the tip of the nose, they think that's where you should be watching the breath. And then you lose the breath, because the breath is not there. It's somewhere else up the nose, at the top of the nose, or somewhere else. You watch the breath where it is, not where it's supposed to be. Sometimes I use the simile of, if I'm going to watch the breath, that I was going to be like some detective, like some spy working for MI5. And then, it doesn't matter where your suspect goes, if I am trailing Venerable Dayalu, yeah, he's not supposed to be in the nuns' quarters, he's a novice. But, if that's where he goes, that's where I have to go. Because I'm trailing him, following him. That's with my breathing. If my breath comes out of my big toe, that's where I've got to look at it. So this is actually how to do the breath meditation. Where is your breath going in? It's going in somewhere. Where's it going out? It's going out somewhere. That's where you have to look. And don't think the breath shouldn't be there. The breath is there. So that's where you watch it. Well, I actually thanked having hay fever because that made me be able to aware of the breath much more easily. During meditation, when I can't locate the breath, I automatically assume I'm holding my breath and panic, interfering by taking a gulp and controlling the breathing, which disturbs the process. It keeps happening. Can you please advise? Look, you may not be able to locate the breath, but the breath is happening. Look, trust me. You have faith in me. You're always breathing. No one has ever died on one of these meditation retreats. You know, you're going to still breathe somehow or other. When you go to bed at night, you're not aware of the breath, but you're still breathing. You don't worry that you're half asleep and you can't find the breath. This is sleep time. Just enjoy it. So when you can't find the breath, fine. The breath will find you. Just relax to the max. To what extent can a supernatural aspect of Buddhism, e.g. monks with rays coming out of their eyes, be explained by quantum physics? It's got nothing to do with quantum physics, but it's weird stuff. How can you explain it? You can't. How can you read minds? How can I had it a couple of times here already? You get two questions and they're so similar. Sometimes they're almost exactly the same, but different handwriting. There is a synchronicity which comes in, especially on retreats. You write out a thought as a question, and somebody else also picks up that thought. And they have such a similar question. And it's just too unlikely by chance. You've actually just synchronized. And that's actually how often how you can read other people's minds and synchronize with them, first of all. But the psychic powers, reading other people's minds, it's quite boring. If you do find the ability to read minds, honestly, how many of your minds are worth reading? There are some emails which you have to read which are so boring and they're just so badly written, you don't want to read them anymore. During the Q&A session, you mentioned about a non-returner residing in a heaven realm. Since he's a non-returner, is it that this being is going to attain arahathood in the heaven? Yeah. It's not like a heaven realm where there's angels with wings and playing harps all the time. This is what they call the Sudhavasa, the pure abodes, where the heavenly beings go. And then when the arahat hood happens, then they vanish away, they disappear. In such heavenly realms, you don't need cemeteries. There's not a body left, this is a mind-made body in a mind-made realm. So you don't need undertakers. The body, just when it finishes, it disappears, fades away and goes. Do you want to go to places like that? Anyway. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can I meditate using two vitaka objects of focus? Crikey. Why do people want to complicate things? Being aware of one's breath at the same time as listening to your voice in a Dhamma talk. Oh my goodness. People say if you listen to my talk, it sends you to sleep. And they say that. So I wouldn't actually try and watch your breath and listen to my talk and go to sleep at the same time. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm, you're right. The word is aware. Be aware of your breath is better than doing breathing meditation. Okay, yeah. You don't do breath meditation. You're aware of the breath. Doing this by force. Do it. Being aware is soft and kind. What is the elephant's name? Nalagiri, how to spell, you spelt it right, N-A-L-A-G-R-R-I. Thanks again. Now we have the last question. Do you reckon it might be a ghost story? No. Desire attachment is one of the stumbling blocks for enlightenment. Even when we meditate, we need to let go of desire. But when we make decisions in tasks, the wanting and our will are inevitable. How do we balance them up? So if you are enlightened, get enlightened first and you'll find the answer to that. Is that good enough? You want another ghost story? A real one?
Yes.
Okay. This.
The lights are
going to
go down.
No, I think. This is a short one. I've already mentioned to you that I was always... Oh, no, okay. Now, this is... I just came to my mind. This is a real one. It actually happened. And this will be good to put the lights down. This is a true story. And it was actually really scary. This happened in Thailand. In Sirirat Hospital. Sirirat Hospital is a huge hospital on the other side of the river from the Menam. From a big river which goes through Bangkok. And one morning, one of the doctors was just finishing his duty. And so he was in the elevator, the lift, going down to the car park where his car was parked. There was another nurse with him in the elevator this time. A witness. And as they were going down to the car park in the basement, the lift stopped. The door opened. There was a patient trying to get into that elevator. The doctor freaked out. And he used his finger and he pressed the close the door button before this patient could get into the elevator. He never explained why. He just pressed it as hard as he could, and the doors closed before the patient could enter. And the nurse was really offended. "You're a doctor. That patient wanted to get into the elevator. Why did you keep him out?" And the did you see? That patient has got this red string on his wrist. And in those days, in the hospitals, if somebody died, they put a red string around their wrist. Now, these hospitals, they always have this little band on their wrists. But that, they don't know if they're alive or dead. But here, they only put the red string on people's wrists when they're dead. "Did you see the red string? That patient was dead. That was one of my patients. Died last night." And this was a doctor who, highly educated, he saw one of his patients standing outside trying to get in the lift. What would you do? Close the lift doors as soon as possible. But then the nurse, she lifted up her hand and said, "I've got a red string too. Does that mean I'm not allowed in the lift?" And then Okay, enough. He fainted. And he was found unconscious on the floor of the elevator. When he was resuscitated, that was the story he told. And of course they did the research, and it was totally true. The patient he described was one of his patients who died that night. And the nurse, she died in a car crash on the way to work that morning. Imagine the bad luck, having a ghost inside or outside. Anyway, the other simple story, another true story, this was of a couple about to get married. And in Australia, this was happening in Adelaide. And then it's usually the case, I've done so many marriage ceremonies, that the bride always comes a few minutes late to the wedding. It's just her way of saying who's going to be boss once they get married. You have to wait for me, not the other way around. But anyway, she arrived late. She came out of the car with her father. And then, it's only then she was told that the groom hadn't arrived yet. You know, sometimes people are late, they get a bit delayed in the traffic. So she was a little surprised and concerned. But you know, she was her marriage day. So she waited and waited and waited. And then of course she started to think, maybe I've been stood up. For one reason or another, my husband-to-be got scared and is not going to turn up. Those are the thoughts going on in her head when she looked down the street and saw him running towards her. He was coming. And when she saw him, you know, he had a suit on, his wedding suit, but it was all sort of disheveled and dusty. And you could see some bruises and cuts on his face. He said, "What happened?" He said, "I was in a car crash." "Well, I'm all right. The car is a write-off, but I came here." And she said, "We're going to take you to hospital." He said, "No, this is our marriage. I want to get married to you. I'll just go into the men's room for 5 minutes, clean myself up, and we'll go through the marriage ceremony," which they did. So they went through the whole marriage ceremony, exchanging rings, you know, and just having the wedding kiss afterwards and signing the wedding register even. And then once they were finished with the ceremony and all the congratulations, it was time to go to another venue to go to the reception. And they wanted time together, so they went in their own car. She drove because he was still a bit shaky after the accident. And all the other family members were following behind. So the couple went on ahead. And then the people coming behind, they saw their car parked by the side of the road. And the bride, still in her wedding dress, was sobbing uncontrollably. And then when they asked, "What happened?" there was no sign of the groom. And she was hysterical. And she related she was driving the car, and it went past this one spot where she eventually parked, and the groom just disappeared into thin air. He just vanished completely away. He was in the car, but he just disappeared. And they found out that that was the place that her husband had the car accident. It was fatal. That was where he died. But he wanted to go through the marriage so much. Literally just created what we call the mind made body. And it was solid enough that, you know, that she could kiss him, sign the marriage register, and go through the whole ceremony. I'm not quite sure what happened afterwards. Was that married or not married? It was a woman who married a ghost, literally. So be careful the next time you get married. But I love that story because it actually says that the desire, the love was so strong that he wanted to go through the ceremony and actually did it, even though he was dead. Made the mind, made body, and she couldn't tell the difference. Anyway, have a wonderful evening. Be careful of going in elevators. Or marrying someone who's a bit late for the service. Sadhu! Sadhu! Sadhu!